You're listening to Red Eye on Vancouver Cooperative Radio, CFRO 102.7 FM.
In the youth-focused culture of the 1960s, the Beatles composed their song, When I'm 64, and their refrain was, Will you still need me? Will you still feed me when I'm 64? In the capitalist crisis of today, the song might be refocused to a refrain about pensions. Will there still be one? Will it still feed me? Now I'm past 64. Sam Gindin is a longtime trade union activist and visiting Packer Chair of Social Justice at York University. He's been thinking a lot and creatively about pensions, and he joins me from his home in Toronto. Good afternoon, Sam, and welcome back to Red Eye.
Hi, good to be here, and your intro really touched a nerve. I happen to be 64.
Okay. The business media have been talking about pensions. What sort of perspective are they offering us?
Well, I think the first thing we should recognize is that on the pension issue, there's been an attack on pensions that has been slowly developing for some time now. The number of people being covered by private pensions has been falling pretty steadily over the last two decades, and even those who have pensions have seen them deteriorate from predominantly defined benefit plans, which means that you know what you're going to get, to defined contribution plans, which means that they put in so much for you and you take the risk about what that'll generate when you actually retire. What's new is there's been an acceleration of the attack. And first of all, it's a part of a general attack. It's a general attack on workers' expectations and lowering them even further. And the second thing I think that's part of this is that they've been watching what the response has been to this crisis. When business should have been weakened and discredited, etc. And what they've seen is that they could ride through this pretty easily. So the combination of the pressures that business feels during the crisis and the fact that labor isn't screaming or demanding things or becoming more radical has actually encouraged business. So they've been moving from saying workers have to get rid of the sense of entitlement, which is really interesting because they've lowered expectations for over 20 years, and it just kind of shows you that if you're not fighting back, it's just going to keep getting worse. But they've been going from there to even further, to not just even talking about the private pension plans. And one of the things I mentioned in the article I did was I just was quoting The Economist that actually called its lead editorial the end of retirement, and they're saying you just can't afford to have retirement anymore. That retirement emerged, the idea of retirement emerged, and they go back to Bismarck in the 19th century when the life expectancy of a worker was 49. So retiring at 65 meant that it was pretty exceptional. And even during the Depression, when Roosevelt introduced a major breakthrough on pensions, retirement age was 65, but life expectancy was around 62. So again, it wasn't going to be a major thing, but even if you got it, you weren't going to get it for very long. And now people are living till age 80, 81, average life expectancy, and they can retire at age 60. So the argument is, well, this is completely demographically unsustainable. And the significance of this argument is that they're no longer attacking private pensions. They're attacking any pensions, people who have government plans and aren't affected by competition directly. And even universal plans, they're saying that you just can't have this luxury anymore.
Well, to pick up on that aspect, what do you say as a response to the argument that life expectancy has increased so much that this is unaffordable, pensions are unaffordable?
Yeah. Can I go back one step? I should have just clarified something. One of the things we've seen with, it really started with healthcare in the United States, and now we're seeing it with pensions, is that the private welfare state doesn't work under neoliberalism and under capitalism at this stage in time. I mean, it isn't just that corporations are aggressive and don't want to give pensions. The whole idea of private insurance was that the company you're getting it from has to survive. And when you've got accelerated restructuring and companies like GM and Chrysler are no longer guaranteed to survive, the question that immediately came up with is, can you have a private welfare state? So that shifted the debate to needing a public welfare state. And then this argument now says that, well, even if you had a public welfare state, and you could technically do it because the government's going to remain there, you can't do it. My response to it, I guess, is at a number of levels. I mean, first of all, these questions aren't, in the end, technical questions. They're questions about priorities. They're questions about, you know, a lot of times you'll get into very technical questions about life expectancy and actuarial funding and how much you have to put in. I mean, those are all valid questions. They have to be considered. But it's ultimately a question of what's our priorities? What do we think that's important? And that raises very fundamental questions about the distribution of income, but also our own priorities, leaving aside even the question of the distribution between labor and capital and the rich and the rest of us. What are our own priorities? Because one of the questions it raises, well, if you're going to work for 40 years and then get 20 years off, you know, that's like half the time you work. You're now being compensated for time off. And is that a good idea? Is that the way you, if you could win time off, pay time off, is that how you'd like to take it? And I think it, you know, forces us to have a very serious debate. One is, how much of this do we want to put into pensions? And one of the things I really want to emphasize is that if we put it into pensions, we really have to address equality of pensions. It's not just so that people maintain their income, their relative income. Some people just don't have access, you know, have been poor their whole lives. The question is, shouldn't they, at least in the last years of their lives, get a decent income? The second question is, if we're going to do this, should we think more about something like phased retirement? Should we say, rather than just leaving the workforce, which actually for a lot of people, it's a mixed blessing, depending on their job and being cut off socially. Maybe we should think about phased retirement. Maybe people should spend 5-10 years in terms of working 3 days a week, as an example. So they begin to adjust to a different kind of a life, and it isn't just abrupt. And that might be supplemented by getting part of your pension over that period. That's one option. The second option, which is what I really wanted to raise in the article, is that it bothers me that we have this notion of, we'll just work our butt off and take all the shit while we're in, you know, the best years of our lives, and then we'll somehow be compensated at the end of it. It's like giving up on most of your life. And there's two basic problems with it. One, you know, three big problems. One is that you might die before you get it. The other is that if we really want to change things in society, you don't give up on your 40 years of working and say, I'm just going to take whatever I can. You actually have to change your everyday life. That's what change has to mean, that our everyday life has changed. And the other dimension of it, which is rarely talked about because we usually focus on sharing jobs, you know, how do we allocate the existing good jobs in the economy, is that if we really expect people to participate politically in changing things, in actively having the time to read and think and go to meetings and go to rallies and talk to other people, then they have to have time in their ordinary life. Otherwise, people are so overwhelmed by their work and their daily chores and the fact that both earners are now, you know, if you've got a two earner family, you're both working full-time, that you don't actually have chance to participate. And what that means ultimately is you don't have the political power to affect anything. So you end up with, even if you had a pension, it gets eroded and you're not strong enough to fight for it.
Well, in your article, you give some examples. Excuse me. One is on how pensions could be structured to achieve, even within this system, greater equality of income. Mm-hmm. And another, you pick up and elaborate a bit more on what you were referring to, excuse me, and that is that you shift pensions from being exclusively at the end of one's working life, and some mm-hmm. way, not just by phasing out your retirement, but mm-hmm. by actually integrating some of that pension scheme into the middle or earlier parts of your working life. I'm wondering if you could give us a little bit of an example, first about greater equality of income, and then secondly, elaborate on this notion of pensions being not exclusively at the end of one's paid employment.
Mm-hmm. Well, the importance of, I mean, one of the things that concerns me about the question of pensions is how unequally they've been distributed. And it's not just a moral question. It obviously is a moral question. But the problem with having benefits that some people have and others don't is that you end up being divided. It's difficult enough when we're united to take on capital at this point in time. But when you have very unequal plans, first of all, if it's in the private sector, you end up being very dependent on your employer. So you're trying to keep them alive, so you end up making concessions. But even when it's in the public plan, if some people have the pension plan and others don't, or others have a very inadequate plan, the people who don't have a good plan are going to resent the others. They're always going to divide you. We're seeing this right now in terms of the attack on the private sector plans is now going to be lead to an attack on municipal workers, provincial workers, federal workers for their pension plans. So equality isn't just a matter of a moral principle. It's actually a practical principle of solidarity so that we can have a decent pension in terms of the distribution of wealth and potential in society. So right now we have in Canada a Canada pension plan and an old age security plan. The Canada pension plan is based on your income. That's where you get most of your pension from. The old age security plan is a set amount that everybody gets. And then there's whatever you do get from your savings or your private. So one of the things that and this is just an example, I'm just arguing that, well, we've got the structure in place. One of the things to think about is, if we're going to improve it, let's really improve the old age security part of it. Let's really raise, we could keep the CPP where it is, for example, and we could set the old age security at 3/4 of the average income. And if you did that, what you would find is somebody who lived their life in poverty, or didn't have an income because they were disabled, whatever, would end up with getting a pension of 3/4 of the average income society, rather than now they'd end up with about 15%, and therefore still live in abject poverty. At least in those years, they could get an average income. Somebody who lived at the average income would end up with a pension around 85% of their average income. And then somebody who, was above that, might get a little bit above the average income, but somebody who is very rich just wouldn't get a large pension from society. And you would fund this through progressive taxes and wealth taxes, so you could resolve this problem of inequality both now and in the future. So that's kind of just roughly an example. I mean, we could come up with other examples, but the principle is clear. The basic allotment that people get as a basic right would be raised. And I think that's a principle that we would think about in terms of poverty today more generally, not even just for pensions, but we'd apply it for pensions. Then the other alternatives are, one is this phased retirement, which I raised, which, just, again, you go to a 4-day week or a 3-day week sometime before retirement. But the last point I was trying to make is the importance of thinking about getting this in your everyday life. And I think that's the kind of issue that we really have to have a debate about our own priorities and how we would do it. We could do it by saying that just by law, everybody, for example, might have an extra week or two during their regular lives, which they have a right to get any kind of education update that they'd like, that they could study computers so that they feel comfortable with them when they're talking with their kids or whatever. And that could be happened by law so that everybody has that right, and it's not just the people who have the power to do it. I think what we should definitely do things like make overtime voluntary. That's just criminal that people are working overtime when other people are short of work. But I think ultimately we have to get to the point of having reduced work week. So something about your everyday life, whether it's a shorter work day that we're working every day or whether we're working 4 days a week, we have to start moving to that. That has to be part of what a civilized society that is constantly seeing improvements in technology and productivity and in our potential, and is also thinking about the environment, which means different kinds of consumption and different ways of enjoying life, would actually think about doing. And once you start thinking about that, you start moving towards a different kind of life and the time to politically participate in a very democratic way, because you've got the time to learn and go to meetings, etc., so we can actually think about larger changes in society to sustain that. Now, I don't think this can happen just by kind of declaring it as a nice policy. I think it would mean that unions have to start taking this on, that as we come out of this recession and we start thinking about what are our priorities now, we actually start thinking about building collectively our collective strength, and that includes the demands that we have. So we're not just in this for ourselves, but we really do try to think of those kinds of examples that can spread, because until unions get this on the agenda and are fighting for it, politicians aren't even going to be thinking about it. If unions can get this on the agenda, then we can start making the fight for generalizing it as a way of life. Now, I want to add one other dimension of it. This is important because I've been talking about reducing work time, which I'm obviously thinking about full-time workers. There's a lot of part-time workers who would also like more work. So a lot of this isn't so much about reduced work time. It's about reducing work time so that everybody's lives are more balanced that way.
Well, thanks a lot for this, Sam, and I'll refer people to the article so that they can delve further into discussing and reflecting on it.
Enjoy talking. Thanks.
Thanks. I've been speaking with Sam Gindin, the visiting Packer Chair in Social Justice at York University. His article, The End of Retirement, is on the website of the Socialist Project under the heading The Bullet 248, or just go to the Red Eye website for a link under our current show, August 29th, and the website for our Red Eye is cooperadio.org/redeye.